Who are the real people we consider our sages? Who were they in life? What is the legacy they left us? Join Rabbi Danny Sackstein for the next hour as he explores the lives of our Torah giants, the spiritual geniuses who shaped the way we approach Judaism today. That's Focus on Our Sages right now on 101.9 Chai FM.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Chai FM and Soul to Soul. Always wonderful to be with you. And I've been on some interesting travels and had some wonderful journeys in the last few weeks. So I'd love to share some of the experiences and inspirations that have been a part of that journey. Before I left, we were talking about, so this show is dedicated to adventures in Jewish history, to a focus on the sages and the great people that lived in the history of Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people, and their impact and influence on the Jewish people, and their spiritual influence and impact through the ages. And to go to places where some of these people lived and where many of them are buried, and where communities flourished for many centuries, was a very powerful experience. So leading up to that, we looked together at the history of Polish Jewry, the history of Lithuanian Jewry, and that gave us a nice overview and background into the communities that lived in Poland and Lithuania. As I've mentioned previously, so I always have had a great dream to go to Lithuania with my parents and to go to the shtetls from where their families emanated and came. And I was always frightened to go, understandably, because to confront the destruction of European Jewry and to be in those places and the death camps is daunting, and is even the thought of it is quite overwhelming. And so I was always frightened to do that without the right framework, without the right guidance, without the right Torah approach. And that's why when our community brought Rabbi Pesach Kron out for Tisha B'Av last year, and Rabbi Kron is a real giant, wonderful orator and speaker and a very special human being, as well as being a big Talmud Chacham. And so therefore I was confident with under Rabbi Kron's leadership that we would approach it from the right perspective, from the right Torah and spiritual perspective. So I said to Rabbi Kron, I've always had this dream, and he said, if you go to the throne, you have to go to Poland, because Poland is just incredible to go. It's a very powerful experience. So we put together this trip of Poland and Lithuania. Originally we intended it for it to be for exclusively for South Africans. But unfortunately, it's being both Poland and Lithuania, so it was a week. The expense is considerable. And so therefore, we had a wonderful group of South Africans that joined us, but the price was prohibitive for many people, although there was tremendous interest right across the full spectrum of the community, but not everybody was in a financial position to be able to afford it. So we had a wonderful group of 13 South Africans, and then we opened it up also to the rest of the world. And there was a strong response from many parts of the world. We had people from England, we had people from Chile, somebody from Amsterdam, most of the group then was from the United States. So overall, we had a group of over 40 people, 13 of them South Africans, and it was really a memorable and unforgettable experience. So what I would like to do, based on the context of the history of those communities that we had discussed, I'd like you to take you through some of the places that we went to and share with you some of the thoughts and the emotions and the background of those tremendous places to visit. So please stay with us, and we're going to get right into it right after this break.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
We're looking at our fantastic journey and inspirational experience to Poland and Lithuania. The way one could probably describe it is from majestic peaks to deep dark valleys, because those are the emotions one experiences when one visits these places. On the one hand, you have the glorious Jewish life that existed there for centuries and the great Talmud Chachamim who lived there and the thriving communities. And then you have the stark contrast of the murder and annihilation of Polish and Lithuanian Jewry. And one's facing constantly these two extremes, and the emotions are deep on both sides. So let me take you through it a little bit. When we arrived, the South Africans arrived early on Wednesday morning, and most of the American group was only arriving Wednesday afternoon. So those few hours in the morning, we landed in Warsaw, and we went to the Jewish Museum of Warsaw. The Jewish Museum of Warsaw was built, was an initiative of the Polish government. The Polish government saw that there were hundreds of thousands, right? And now currently there are over 1 million tourists to Auschwitz every year. And so you had these large numbers of people coming to Poland and visiting the death camps, and one only got a perspective of the death and destruction of Jewish life in Poland. And the Polish government wanted there to be an appreciation and an understanding of the rich Jewish life before the Holocaust, before the Shoah, that existed in Poland. And so they decided to build a museum in order to go take one through that history. And they started raising money for it, so they allocated some funds, and they were very short to complete the museum. And ultimately, a Holocaust survivor from Poland assisted financially and ended up paying for the majority of the museum. It cost in excess of $20 million, and it is an absolutely outstanding museum. As I discussed, we've been looking in the history of Polish Jewry, so I did some extensive research before we left, and I found that the museum covered that and much more, and was accurate, and it was very well done, and definitely worth one's while if one finds oneself in Warsaw at any stage. Don't miss the museum. The museum's built on the site where the Warsaw Ghetto uprising began, so it's in the area where the ghetto was, and it's on that very site where the uprising started. And it is really outstanding to go through the different parts of the museum, the different displays, and they take you through Polish Jewry from the beginning, from the 14th century, where the Jewish population began to grow in Poland. They were invited by King Kazimierz to come into Poland and to build the land and to develop the economy. The Jews were fleeing persecution from Western Europe, where the Black Plague had broken out, and Jews were blamed for much of the dying that was going on, because the incidence in the Jewish community was far less, as we discussed, because observant Jews are washing their hands all the time when they wake up, before they eat, after they eat, after they go to the bathroom, and which was not the case in non-Jewish society. And as a result, the spread of bacteria was far less, and the incidence was far less within the Jewish community. And the non-Jews looked at this with great suspicion and said that it must be that the Jews are, there's a conspiracy and the Jews are poisoning our wells. And so they began to attack the Jews, and many thousands of Jews were murdered at the end of the 14th century, and fled Western Europe. One of the places they came was Poland, and another place they came was Lithuania, because they were welcomed in Poland and Lithuania. Poland and Lithuania were of the most hospitable societies in Europe for Jews at the time, and the ruling classes of those places embraced the Jews and wanted the Jews to come, and promised the Jews protection from the king, from the royal family in Poland. And interesting, in Krakow, where the King Kazimierz has built his palace, the Jewish quarter is right next to his palace, because they were promised and were granted protection from the king and from the king's forces. And so Jews began to move to Poland, and that trickle turned into a very strong flow, and it didn't take very long for Poland to be the largest Jewish community in the world. By the time the Second World War broke out, there were in the region of 3.3 million Jews living in Poland. It was 10% of the Polish society, and the Jews were prosperous in Poland. The Jews were very influential economically. As I discussed a few weeks ago, the Jews were involved in three major occupations. The Jews controlled the liquor industry, which was a thriving business in Poland, because the East Europeans enjoyed their alcohol and are largely alcoholic societies. Unfortunately, even to this day, over 50% of Russia are registered alcoholics, which is an interesting statistic. So the Jews were the providers of the alcohol. They had distilleries, they had taverns, they had large reserves of the alcohol that they would serve. And there was one profession. Another profession of the Jews were the agents of the noblemen, of the porots, who would be the noblemen who would have the tenant farmers, the serfs on their land. And the Jews would very often be the go-between, the middleman, and collect the rent on behalf of the noblemen. And the Jews were, so those two professions were not very popular, because it meant that the Jews were the ones that the non-Jews were primarily giving their money to, either for the alcohol or for their rent. After that, there was very little left. So they were viewed with some sort of, with a bit of resentment as a result. And there was plenty of church-sanctioned anti-Semitism in Poland. Poland is a very strongly Roman Catholic country. Over 95% of the residents are not just Roman Catholic, but they're observant Roman Catholic, more than any other country in Europe and probably the world. And so that whole mix did create an environment of anti-Semitism. And so things began to turn for the worse for the Jews in Poland with the Chmielnytsky uprising in 1648. Bogdan Chmielnytsky was a Ukrainian peasant who led an uprising against the upper class, against the noblemen. The Jews were seen on the side of the noblemen, and their different views according to the historians, but the general consensus is in excess of 150,000 Jews were murdered by the Cossacks of Chmielnytsky, and that was really the beginning of the end of the positive life of Jews in Poland. Jews still remained for many centuries, and that was obviously it took a long time for the end to come, but it went downhill from 1648, from Chmielnytsky. Although the Jews were still very prominent and very successful and had a very good experience in Poland. And then we had the advent of Hasidus and the spread of Hasidus throughout Poland, which we'll speak about in a moment. So the first place we went to was the museum, which was fascinating and very worthwhile. We then went to pick up the rest of the group. And we went to the single surviving shul in Warsaw from the Second World War. Before the war broke out, there were 400 shuls, 400 synagogues in Warsaw. This was the only one that survived. It's called the Noisk Shul. It was built in 1900. It's a beautiful shul. And still to this day, it's kept up by the Jewish community in Warsaw, which is very small. There's around about 3,500 Jews left. But the shul is, they have minyanim there, and it is a museum in the day. And it does give one a view of the richness of the life of the Jewish community before the Second World War. It was actually in the ghetto, the shul. The Nazis used it for a stable during the war, but it was restored afterwards, and it now is a beautiful shul to visit. We went from there to the Warsaw Cemetery. The Warsaw Cemetery is an incredible place. It's a bit strange to say that about a cemetery, but there's a deep, powerful, mystical energy over there. There are many holy people buried there, many holy Jews buried there. There's these big trees, and the sun was setting, and it was quite a powerful energy that we experienced when we went there. The two graves that we went to at the beginning, which were obviously very moving, were the graves of the Netziv and of Rab Chaim Soloveitchik. The Netziv, Rab Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, was the great Rosh Yeshiva of the Volozhin Yeshiva. He took over as Rosh Yeshiva towards the middle of the 19th century. And he was a great leader, a great genius, a tremendous Rosh Yeshiva, somebody who was very successful in passing Torah to the next generation. He was beloved by his students and beloved by the community. And he was actually the Rosh Yeshiva when the Yeshiva closed down. So remember when we spoke about the Yeshiva movement in Lithuania, and Volozhin was the first Yeshiva, the mother of all Yeshivas, which opened in 1812. Volozhin was greatly successful in educating a new generation of Torah scholars, was started by Rav Chaim of Volozhin at the guidance and vision of his Rebbe, the Vilna Gaon. And that transformed Torah learning in Lithuania and later the entire Jewish world. So Volozhin was the mother of all yeshivas. All the other great yeshivas that opened Lithuania came from Volozhin. In other words, the Rosh Yeshiva studied in Volozhin and then moved back to their towns and opened their own yeshivas. The Netziv was the Rosh Yeshiva when the yeshiva was closed in 1897. The communist government, the Russians, sorry, it wasn't the communists, it was the Tsarist Russia, in 1897, had taken over Lithuania, which happened many times, and they put a tremendous amount of restrictions on the students. They hardly let them learn Torah. They had to learn secular studies most of the day. It became impossible to keep the yeshiva open. And so they had no choice but to close it. And they would find that at night there were footsteps that in the snow, when the sun set, there were no footsteps. In the morning, they would see these footsteps every night to the yeshiva building. And nobody could work out why that was so until somebody decided to stay and see what was going on. And every midnight, which was Chatzos HaLayla is midnight, the Netziv would walk to the yeshiva and say Tikkun Chatzos. Tikkun Chatzos is the prayer that holy people say and lament over the destruction of the temple, over the exile that we're in. The Netziv would go and say Tikkun Chatzos every night at the yeshiva because he felt that it was a great display of the hardship of being in Galus, in exile, and of the suffering of the Jewish people, that we can't have our own institutions of Torah learning in the countries we find ourselves. So Netziv was a beloved person, a powerful leader, and somebody of great spiritual stature. The other grave, and he's buried right next to the Netziv, is Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. And we have discussed Rav Chaim briefly before. Rav Chaim was the genius of Torah learning in Lithuania. Rav Chaim's mind was not counted, second to none in all of Europe. He was an absolute genius. And he came up with a whole new approach of learning, of lamdas, of deep analytical thought, with a whole vocabulary that went along with it. And his approach to learning transformed Volozhin and transformed all of Lithuania. The entire, all the yeshivas in Lithuania were from the students of Reb Chaim. They were Talmidim of Reb Chaim, and they used Reb Chaim's derech. And therefore, today, one won't find one of the classic yeshivas that doesn't follow the approach of Reb Chaim's learning in Iwan, in analytical thought, when one's learning the Gemaras, when taking apart the Gemaras and the Rishonim, based on Reb Chaim's work on the Rambam. So he was a great genius. Chaim was also the rabbi of Brisk, the town of Brisk. So Rav Chaim was one of the joint Rosh Yeshivas of Volozhin. He married the granddaughter of the Netziv, and they worked together. In fact, they had very different styles. The Netziv's style was more of a Bekir style, was more of a covering ground and getting information and acquiring information. And Rav Chaim's style was a slow analytical approach to understanding, peeling back the layers and getting to the central core principles of Torah, of the Torah Shebaal Peh, which is a very demanding intellectual exercise, but very stimulating and rewarding. And they worked together in Volozhin until the yeshiva closed. Rav Chaim was the Rabbi Brisk. His father was the Rabbi Brisk before him, the Beis HaLevi. And then Rav Chaim Soloveitchik also was the Rabbi Brisk. There are many legendary stories about Rav Chaim in Brisk and running the community in Brisk. His son was the Briskerov, Rav Velvel Soloveitchik. So, it's an interesting thing because I come from Lithuania. I'm what we call a Litvak. And I'm, you know, very much, bound by the Torah Shebaal Peh, the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law. And I'm not so into all of these like airy fairy kind of spiritual things. So I wondered how I would, deal with going to the graves and the cemeteries of righteous people that are buried in Europe. And I was very much taken by surprise that the energy there is quite incredible. We know our holy tradition teaches us that the neshama of a righteous person, there's some part of it, there's some aspect of it that still remains connected to what's in the grave, although the main parts of the Neshama go to the eternal world. And we also know, according to our holy tradition, that where a righteous person is buried, all the sluyos, all of the merits that they generated in their lifetime are gathered in that place and went up to Shemayim in that place, whatever that means. So you connect to that pathway and that channel when you go there. Now, of course, we don't daven to that person. That's not Judaism. We don't daven to people. We daven to God. We daven directly to God. We don't need any intermediaries as Jews. But what we do is we daven in the merit of this righteous person that Hashem should answer our prayers, and that that person should be a Melitz Yushar, should be a advocate on our behalf in the eternal world. And one finds that it's a very powerful experience to do so, to go and daven in the merit. We, of course, we were with Rabbi Pesach Kron, the great world-renowned Maggid, and Rabbi Kron, he introduced each of the individuals by whose graveside we visited. And that helped us tremendously because, firstly, we got insight into the person's life and into their spiritual achievements. And he also framed it in a way that we should ask for things, daven to Hashem for things that related to that individual. So, for example, at the grave of the Rama, he said we should daven that Hashem should give us the ability to keep halacha, because the Rama was a great poisek of Klai Yisrael. And at the grave of the Vilna Gaon. So we'll, please God, get to all of these places and discuss them in more detail. Rav Grant said the Vilna Gaon was a great genius in Torah. We should daven for das, for clarity of mind, that we should live our lives in the correct way. So that was also of great assistance. But it is a very powerful experience to go daven at the graves of these righteous people. One feels a tremendous boost and spiritual energy over there. So that's where we started, in the cemetery in Warsaw. The cemetery in Warsaw also has another fascinating aspect to it. And that is, during the Warsaw ghetto, the breadwinners for the families were the little children. Why? Because the little children would escape. In the ghetto itself, there was no food. In the ghetto itself, everybody was dying of starvation. And the Germans did that on purpose. They dehumanized the Jews. They weakened the Jews. First thing they did is they removed them from their property, from their assets. They, forced them into tiny ghettos. The ghetto was, at the time of when the war broke up on the 1st of September 1939. So we've just had the 80th anniversary of that. So there was, in Warsaw at the time, there were in excess of 350,000 Jews, which was, I think, 370,000 Jews is the number. And that was one third of the population of Warsaw. And they were all squeezed into this tiny ghetto. And there wasn't enough space, there wasn't enough food, sanitary conditions were non-existent. It was just disastrous. And so the way people would get food is the small children would fit into the sewers and would go out of the sewers, go out of the ghetto through the sewers, and they would smuggle back food for their families. That's really the primary way that people kept alive in the ghettos. And in the Warsaw Cemetery, there's an amazing place which tells a story about these children, which I'll share with you after this break.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
We're talking about the Warsaw Cemetery, and there's a place right in the middle of the cemetery which was like a kind of bunker in between the graves. And nobody really knew what that was and why it was there. Until 5 years ago, somebody visited the cemetery, and there's a certain rabbi in Warsaw who takes care of the cemetery and all of the Jewish community needs. And this person was with that rabbi, and he said, "Do you know what that spot is?" The rabbi said, "No, we've been trying to research. We don't know what that is." He said, "That is a hole that connects with the sewer line in Warsaw. And that is a place," he said, very often the sewers were, there's so many kids coming in and out that a kid would have to stay overnight outside of the ghetto walls. And the cemetery was outside of the ghetto walls. And they would hide in this little area, which was like a bunker. And very often children would spend the night over there cuddled together until they could get back in, smuggle themselves back into the ghetto and give food to their family. So it was only recently that was found out. So we saw the spot, which is quite unbelievable to see. And it just makes that experience more real when one is in that place. we then went on to a place called the Umschatzplatz. The Umschatzplatz was the central platform from where the Jews of Warsaw were sent to their deaths. The Jews of Warsaw, when the Warsaw Ghetto was liquidated, were sent to Treblinka, and they were sent from this platform. And right, the Germans destroyed it entirely, so there's nothing left. But there's a monument that stands in that place. And on that monument, there are many names. Names of people. And many, many hundreds of names in alphabetical order. And it's very powerful to stand there and to look at those names and to find one's own name, to find one's parents' names or grandparents' names, to find one's children's names, and to think that they were just like us. They were regular Jewish people like all of us. And they were sent to their deaths. They were murdered by the Nazis. And it really hits home of how fortunate we are to live in our country here in South Africa with very little anti-Semitism, free to live our Jewish lives as we want, and being able to build thriving communities, Bli Ein Hara. And how fortunate we are to live in a time where the Jewish people are able to develop and thrive, where we have a state of Israel, and we the state of Israel is growing and is strengthening, and so may it continue. And so we really are blessed that we didn't live 80 years ago, but we live in these times. And it's very moving to see those names and to see names of family members and to put one's mind back, you know, 80 years, and to think what it was like for those Jews, just like all of us, to be sent to their deaths by the Nazis. We then had dinner, and we didn't stay in Warsaw. We stayed in Lublin. Now, it's quite a long drive. It's over a two-hour drive from Warsaw to Lublin. And we went via Gier. Now, you may remember we'd spoke in quite a lot of detail about the development of Hasidus in Poland, about the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov was the founder of Hasidus, and he developed a movement, an organization, which had a massive impact on Polish Jewry. The Baal Shem Tov was born in 1698. He was born on the 18th of Elul, 1698, which is actually his birthday is coming up soon. He died on the 6th of Sivan, 1760. And he led a tremendous revolution almost in Yiddishkeit with the development of the Hasidus movement. Hasidus movement, which focuses on one's, the greatness of an individual and how an individual soul has infinite ability and has a unique place in God's universe, how God's hashkocha, God's control, is everywhere and controls every aspect, big and small, of the universe. The emphasis in Hasidus is joy, the joy of learning Torah, the joy of mitzvahs, the joy of serving Hashem. And this movement spread across Poland through the Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov. Well, the primary Talmid was Rav Dov Ber, the Magid of Mizrich, and the Magid had a number of outstanding students who were responsible for the spread of Hasidus, like Rabbi Elimelech of Lizhensk, and Rabbi Shneur Zalman, the Alter Rebbe, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Nachum Twersky of Chernobyl, of the dynasty of Chernobyl, Rav Levi Yitzhak of Berdichev, the Chozem Liblin. All of these were great Talmidim of the Magid of Mizrich, who were responsible then for spreading Hasidus throughout Poland. We also discussed how there was a interesting shift with time within the world of Hasidus, and many of the Hasidic communities were no longer that strong on Limud HaTorah and on the depth of Torah study. And as a result, there was almost a counter-revolution within Hasidus. And we discussed, if you remember, the Chozem Lublin, Rav Yaakov Yitzchak Horovitz. So he had a Talmud, which was his namesake also, Yaakov Yitzchak Horovitz, the Yidda Kadosh, and the Yidda Kadosh broke away, and he went to a place called Pshischa, and in Pshischa they developed a new group of Hasidim, where they were very much focused on Torah study, and on self-growth, and on spiritual development, and on discipline, And that group then, the one who took over from the Yid HaKadosh was Rav Simcha Bunim of Peshitta, and then after Rav Simcha Bunim was the Chidush HaHarim, Rav Yitzchak Meir Alta, and they were somewhat ostracized by the rest of the Hasidim, and there was the famous wedding in Ostila, where they were put on trial, where the Chidush HaHarim was there, and the other Hasidim were pressuring the elder statement of Hasidus at the time, the Apter Rov, Rav Avram Yeshua Heschel. He was the Oy of Yisrael. And the Apter Rov would not listen to the pressure, and he spoke at length with Chidush HaHarim. Chidush HaHarim was the greatest genius in Torah in Poland at the time. And the Apter Rov said that they are legitimate and strong. And eventually, he wouldn't put them in Chayrim. The Kotzker Rebbe took over from the Rav Simcha Bunim, and then the Chidush HaHarim took over from him. And that's when the line of Ger, of Guru, began. The Chidush HaHarim, as I mentioned, was an unbelievable genius, and his Torah learning was actually the similarities to the style of Reb Chaim. He just didn't have the vocabulary of Reb Chaim. Many great people have said that. So the Chidush HaHarim built a Hasidus which was focused entirely on Limud HaTorah and on developing oneself to one's potential to great spiritual heights. And he built Ger, which his grandson took over from him. He had a tragic life. He lost 13 of his all 13 of his children died in his lifetime. The only relative, his only descendant he had was his grandson, because his son had died at a young age. His grandson was Sfas Emes, who took over, Yehuda Leib Alta, took over the Hasidus of Ger, and they built Ger into the largest group of Hasidim in Poland. So we were zoicha, we had the great honor and privilege to daven in the courtyard of the Ger Hasidim by their base midrash, and then we went to the kvarim, to the graves of the Chidush HaHarim and the Sfas Emes, which was also an incredible experience. We arrived there in the dark of night. It was mysterious and powerful, and you know, the person who looks after the cemetery opened for us. It was close to midnight. And to daven at their kfarim was very, very moving, and a very powerful experience. But stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
We went from Ger to Lublin. Lublin, is one of the largest towns in Poland, and Lublin is the place of Rabbi Meir Shapiro. Rabbi Meir Shapiro was the great rabbinic leader in the beginning of the 20th century in Lublin. Genius, a person of tremendous talent and ability and great genius. He was a visionary. He was a member of parliament in Lublin. He was somebody who had a great influence on the Jewish people. And he was the individual who came up with the concept of Daf Yomi, of learning a daf a day, which we'll speak about in a moment. One of the major projects of Rabbi Meir Shapiro was to build a grand yeshiva in Lublin. It was the first yeshiva to be built in Poland. As I mentioned, in Lithuania, the yeshiva movement took off and spread, and there were great centers of learning in many different towns. But in Poland, the style was still to learn in the shuls, to learn in the chadarim, not to have yeshivas that were designated for Torah learning, per se. It was mainly done in the shuls and the Bate Midrashos that people learned. They learned in small groups. They learned with the rabbi. Ramesh Shapiro wanted to build a yeshiva, a grand, magnificent yeshiva, which would be fitting of the honor of Torah and would be a center of learning for all of Polish Jewry. And he fundraised extensively for it, and he built this magnificent building, a very large base midrash. There were four floors. There were two big dining rooms and many comfortable dormitories for the students to stay in. And a massive library, which was one of the largest libraries, Torah libraries in all of Europe. And Rabbi Meir succeeded in actualizing his dream. And in 1930, the great Chochme Lublin, Yeshiva Chochme Lublin, Yachal it was called, Yeshiva Chochme Lublin, was opened. And it became for the short amount of time of 9 years, it didn't even see the decade out until the war broke out, it became a shining light of Torah for all of Klal Yisrael. And it's now been turned, the building is still there, the building has not been destroyed. Unlike Warsaw, Lublin is very much intact. What happened in Warsaw was the local population rebelled against the Germans. There was a Warsaw uprising. There wasn't only the Warsaw Ghetto uprising, but there was the Warsaw City uprising. When the Russians were coming near, the Russians communicated with the partisans and said, rebel against the Germans and then we'll come in. And so the partisans gave the Germans everything they had, and the Germans responded ruthlessly, and they absolutely crushed the partisans and crushed the city. They bombed the city. Warsaw was almost entirely flattened by the Germans because of the uprising. And the Russians were close enough to come in, and they didn't. They waited. They waited for the Germans to destroy the uprising, which there's much to be said about. So on the one hand, Warsaw is relatively a new city today because most of it was destroyed in World War II. But Lublin is not. And so Lublin is still intact, and the building of the Chochmei Lublin is intact. It's now a hotel. It's a 4-star hotel. We stayed in the hotel. So the dormitories were turned into a hotel. And it was really a great experience to be there, to be in the building. And next week we'll talk about our incredible experience in the Beis Midrash. We had a siyum in the Chochmei Lublin. And we'll then take our journey further, which is very enlightening and moving and inspiring. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.